Litcast Slovakia, the podcast about Slovak literature in English. Welcome to Litcast Slovakia number 9. I'm your host, Julia Sherwood, and today I'll be talking to Natasha Djurovičová. Natasha Djurovičová studied at the University of Lund, University of California at Santa Barbara, and at University of California, Los Angeles. She is now based at the University of Iowa, where she teaches its International Translation Workshop, part of the university's renowned International Writing Program, and teaches courses on translation and globalization, and translation and media. She divides her time between editing, teaching, scholarly working, and sometimes also translating. Ahoj, Natasha. Welcome to Litcast Slovakia.
Thank you.
Here in London, we're in the middle of a heat wave. How are things in Iowa? I hear you've had some freak weather the other day.
It's not. The heat wave was there until yesterday, and that was concluded by an enormous storm which pulled down electricity, power, internet, and unfortunately hundreds of old trees. There's a reason for why this place is called a prairie, you know, as in meadow. The wind really takes things out terribly. So, yeah. So sad, very sad, but fine.
Well, I'm glad to hear you're safe, and I really appreciate that you managed to make it to our recording rendezvous in these circumstances. So now let me go back in time to the experience of exile that the two of us have in common. We were both born in Czechoslovakia, but while I was forced into exile in my 20s, you ended up in exile when you were quite young. You grew up in Sweden and now live in the US, but in spite of that, you have kept up your Slovak. I guess that has something to do with your family background. As the daughter of Professor Lubomír Djurovič, doyen of Slavonic studies in Czechoslovakia, and a journalist mother. So I wonder how the experience of exile shaped you and your family.
Well, the experience of exile is one that, changes everything, and it's completely fundamental. I don't think that anything that happens once you have that point of no return as your baseline, anything's ever the same. And so to answer that properly would be a novel or a psychiatry session. Yes, it changed everything. But you know, Sweden has been an incredibly generous and welcoming country, and I, for the rest of my life, will owe a debt of gratitude to Sweden as a country and as a society for having let us in, taken us in as well as they did, and has been as generous and as welcoming as they have been. So that's one way of putting it. Yeah.
And the rest of your family?
My father eventually became a professor of Slavic languages and had a very successful career, was very happy and very productive. My mother, Ljudmila Djurovičová, whose name I feel like I want to say, was the one who bore the brunt of the decision. The decision was made jointly by all of us, but as it so often is the case, it was the journalist and the writer who lost the opportunities and ended up really working extremely hard and with a great deal of personal sacrifice to endure the exile. The family configuration was, you could say, one very, very successful and one very reasonably accommodated but very sad woman, you know. And then, of course, 89 happened, and then they could return. But, you know, you lose 20 years of your life. And it's difficult, and we all know how that goes. And it's something that really divides us from people who've never left.
Yeah, and losing your language, if you're a writer, really is the worst thing that can happen. But you didn't lose a language, you've gained several, and you've been involved in so many things, too much to cover, really, in this brief conversation. And I hope we'll get around to that some other time. But now let's focus on literature, starting with the Walt Whitman Project. Can you say a few words about that?
The international writing program, of which we're Walt Whitman, the Whitman Web, as we call it, is just one of the many dozens of digital projects, is a program that is now 5 decades old and was built around a kind of a combination of writers who come to Iowa, sponsored by the U.S. Department of State, previously by some other U.S. Information agency, etc., and many private arts grantees. So the group of about 30 people that come every year is in Iowa physically. But as the internet has gotten more and more important, it was clear to everybody that we would be needing to think about how to make the IWP act also online and in the digital space. And the Whitman Web is one of the many projects that were the result of that kind of thinking. In particular, Whitman Web was originally funded by the U.S. Department of State as an effort to create a rapprochement to, of all places, Iran. So this is during the Obama years when Iran was off limits but needed to be somehow contacted. And so somebody came up with the idea that this, Walt Whitman's the great American text of American modern literary modernism and the American, if you will, democracy or sort of ideal of democracy, that has not been translated into Persian. So we commissioned the translation into Persian and then came up with this design where we would release a stanza. The Song of Myself has 52 stanzas, so we would decide that we would release a stanza of the American, of the original version, and of the Persian version each week. So we'd have a year-long project, and each stanza was prefaced by a commentary by a scholar, Ed Folsom, who is a terrific Whitman scholar based here at the University of Iowa, and it would be commented on by a poet, Chris Merrill, who runs this program. And those commentaries would be also translated into Persian. So it was a kind of a creation of a digital object, if you will, and we started with English and Persian, and then found and started looking around and soliciting either open source or specifically commissioned translations from other languages. And so we now have Song of Myself, which we then added to the website, and we now have translation in 13 languages total, including Malay, Polish, two Arabic translations done by two different people. Very, very differently, two different Russian versions, one of Tchaikovsky's and one of a very young woman translator, etc., etc. It's just been really exciting to think about it as a way of doing translation in kind of a comparative spirit, which is what the internet is the best. You know, it's an ideal medium for that. So, and we're just waiting for a Turkish translation to be delivered. And if there's somebody out there who has a Slavic translation or is interested in creating one, I would love to hear from you.
Wonderful, wonderful. So here's a little challenge there. And can you just say a few more words about the International Writing Program for those listeners who are not so familiar with it? How does it work and what are its main goals?
So, Iowa has this prehistory of creative writing, which is quite distinct and definitely. It's what is Iowa known for in the United States? It's known for two things. It's corn and pork, as it's raised with the corn, and for creative writing. So these two things, these two things, export articles are what makes Iowa visible to people, and among academics, I guess writing more than the corn. The writer's workshop started here. The teaching of creative writing, a topic to which we might return a little later in this interview, teaching of creative writing started here and sort of picked up with a particular vigor by a poet whose name is Paul Engel, after World War II. He was a local guy but very cosmopolitan. Built up the translation, the writer's workshop, which is for American writers, in the late 40s and early 50s, is very, very successful. And as he traveled the world, and at the same time as he was in his own sort of cosmos effort to render this provincial part of the United States relatively invisible again, a more cosmopolitan and more international. He was very interested in the idea of bringing international writers to the writers' workshop. He then got funding from the Rockefeller Foundation, who said, "How do you want to do this?" And so, at some point, the writers' workshop started having a substantive number of writers from other countries who either wrote in English or wrote in another language and translated to and from English. So this international writing program has a kind of a seedbed inside of the writers' workshop, but they are not interchangeable. The writers' workshop continues today. It's a very, very prestigious organization for granting a master's in creative fine arts and creative writing for people, for writers from all over the world. But the international writing program then became autonomous. Sort of set itself free from the writer's workshop. It's not an academic program. We don't grant a degree, but we're simply an international residency where writers from all over the world come now for about 3 months, originally for almost a year, to simply coexist and to write. And so we will be celebrating our 55th anniversary in the year 2022. And we've had, over 1,600 writers who've come here. And, it's a, the program really is a kind of a distinct kind of a flagship, one of the flagship programs of University of Iowa, and something that we're really, we have people everywhere, as it were. It's a very, the network is enormous. We are trying to figure out how to do this in the era of COVID. So this fall is actually the first fall ever that we have not had 3 dozen or so of writers come to Iowa City, but we hope to resume again in spring and keep your fingers crossed for us.
I certainly will. And so you have now explained the difference between the writer's workshop and the international writing program. And then there is the translation workshop. So how do these all these workshops link to one another, and who attends the translation workshop? Is it students at Iowa University, or have I got that completely wrong?
No. You parse the acronyms right, and this is the great plague of the American academic life, or life in general, acronyms. So the Writers' Workshop gave birth, as it were. The International Writing Program became autonomous, or sort of exited itself as an autonomous organization. Similarly, the Writers' Workshop started very early on. They've always had a workshop, which is a kind of a same language workshop, and this is a kind of a unique Iowa model in and of itself. The idea that it's not a master teacher who critiques, who comments on your writing, but rather the group of your readers work together. It's a very collectively organized kind of enterprise. And there was inside of the Writers' Workshop, some in the early 60s, a poet was invited from Princeton who was bilingual, English and Greek, and Paul Engels said, "Why don't you teach a writer's workshop, a translation workshop, since we have so many international participants?" And Mike Keeley, that was his name, said, "What's that?" And Paul said, "I have no idea, just make it up." And so the translation workshop was born, and originally it served simply as a way in which the international participants could work on drafts together with the American colleagues and produce new work in English. In other words, there it was geared towards really creative writing in English, and Keeley has been very explicit about saying that his goal has been was entirely to produce to focus on the target language, which in this case was completely English. That was the only criterion. Now, but from that mix, from that kind of working group mix, eventually there came an impulse to start an actual academic program in literary translation. And that happened in 1971 or two, when an MFA in literary translation was opened inside, alongside was a program in comparative literature. So Writers' Workshop is an academic program that grants a degree. The MFA in Literary Translation is also an academic program that grants a degree, and then International Writing Program is simply a residency. So that's an administrative way of explaining the various the varieties.
Right.
But it's a great symbiosis because we get students from the Writers' Workshop who come over to the IWP to work with writers. Most of the participants in the International Translation Workshop, which I teach, are students who come over from the academic side, from the comparative literature department, to work with the visiting writers. And sometimes we just get people who come from the community. It's completely open. So that, I think that's the floor plan, that's the map, but I don't know if you want to ask any more questions about it.
Maybe just how long you've actually been involved with this program?
I was hired a week before 9/11, so do the
We'll leave our listeners to do the math.
Right.
I'm really no good
It's been a while. It's been a
arithmetic.
while.
Yes, right. Okay. So back to the IWP. Over the years, you mentioned hundreds of writers from 150 countries have taken part in the program, including several from several Czech and Slovak writers. So, can you mention some of them that stayed in your memory and how and what kind of mark they've made?
So in during the years of Cold War, let's say pre-89, Paul Engel, who parenthesis here, in as he was starting out the program, married a Taiwanese novelist, Chinese Taiwanese novelist, Nie Hualing Engel. So the two of them together started, they are really the two co-founders of the program, and Hualing's name must be mentioned again, and not forgotten in this context. The two of them started the program with the ambition to, so often they would refer to the IWP as the United Nations of Writers. And they were very interested in bringing writers from, as it were, polarized and divided parts of the world. So their interest in East Europe was obviously in the Cold War context, that there was no way of escaping the flavor of politics. But on the other hand, it was also Nie Hualing's experience as a refugee from the People's Republic of China to Taiwan that colored her experiences and her very actively dissenting stance against the Chiang Kai-shek regime in Taiwan, etc., as well. That I think gave them a special focus and special interest in bringing writers who themselves might be in trouble to some extent. And so clearly, people who were, we're coming from Czechoslovakia after 1968, would have been prime candidates. But then the goal was not simply to, as it were, operate in the Cold War paradigm, but rather to bring people from a variety of different backgrounds. So among the first person who was brought in from Czechoslovakia, who wasn't actually brought in from Czechoslovakia because by then he'd been in exile in Israel and was badly needing a place to come and write and simply survive, was Arnoš Lustig, whom Paul Engel, I've looked at the correspondence, and it's kind of remarkable how much work, how much trouble Engel went into to fund, first find funding for him to perhaps not come into the United States, but certainly to come from New York with his family, two kids and a wife, to Iowa, find work for him, find assignments for him, find writing commissions for him. I mean, the incredibly warm relationship. And Lustig wrote some rather wonderful poems about Iowa to Engel personally in Czech, which
Yeah,
I have
really.
yet to, and one day I will get around to translating. They're really quite charming. And that was clearly a very, very intimate relationship. And I think they stayed in contact by correspondence even after Lustig returned to Prague. So at least for with Hualing, Paul was died soon after 89. But and then in 1968, the first person they invited was Václav Havel, and Havel accepted, and we have the letter of documentation for that. And then the 21st of August happened, so Havel didn't. But Havel's intent to come was here, and in fact we reissued an invitation, and again we got a very affirmative answer. But by then his cancer was so far along that he no longer was able to come. But we would have really loved to have brought him back. Among the Slovak writers, we
Course.
have Mila Haugová, Michal Hvorecký, most recently Robert Galf, originally from Bratislava, but now coming to us from through Prague. And among the Slovaks, we have We have Peter Machowski. Gustav Murin was the first after 95. Peter Machowski, then Michal Horecký, Jana Beňová. So we do our best, and we do love to have them try. And we are always, we are always encouraging the embassies and the cultural attachés to keep an eye on and recruit people. So maybe that's a segue to one of your other questions down the line about how one applies and how one enters the program.
Okay, thank you. So maybe we can actually skip that question since you've answered it. But just go back to the International Writing Program, which fits into a long tradition of creative writing courses in the US, where they are very popular. Although, in fact, recently there's been some backlash against it. And they're now slowly getting established in Slovakia as well. For example, one of them by your former alumnus, Michal Horecký. So, can you say what you see as the main benefits of such courses for an aspiring writer? And also, are there any possible drawbacks?
Yeah, I think it's a great question, and I have been kind of keeping an eye on that and thinking about it for a long time, because I think the answer there lies in some profound cultural cleft. Even on the surface, it looks like it's the same project that proliferates. But I think the cleft comes from the fact that you could say that in Europe, and I'm going to generalize grossly, but let's say outside of the United States, that, and I think that goes for Latin America as well as for Asia, a writer is somebody who, in the kind of a romantic, now I don't mean romantic as in emotionally romantic, but I mean in the historical, literary,
Yes.
critical, romantic sense, writes from an inner need, and his success or his relevance is deemed based on the degree to which she or he speaks to a current situation or a current need, whether it's a readerly need or a political need or a social need. In other words, the notion of the writer as an organic intellectual is something that we all have to, you're outside of the United States, this is taken extremely seriously. That's the reason why the ethical dimension of writing and the sense of the heroic writer who writes towards truth with Jan Hus, right, is such a foundational concept. In the United States has a completely different intellectual tradition. And there, I would say that the foundation for what today manifests itself as these creative writing courses really comes from a much more pedagogically oriented and, let's say, educational point of departure. I think it comes from the American sort of innovation or innovative philosophical stance of pragmatism, and that where the chief rule is learn by doing, not learn by absorbing, by reading, by in some ways complying with the educational or with the cultural paradigm, but rather by breaking out autonomy and independence. So when cre and in fact, when you historically creative writing in this country started being taught at universities as a class in the 1920s already, when you started having the first courses in screenwriting in Los Angeles at the University of Southern California. So from the beginning, the writer becomes a much more utilitarian, practical, and you might say professional label rather than the voice of nation or an expression of a inner need or something like that. These are two completely different notions of what a writer should be doing. And of course, and so in the United States, and if we take Iowa, that was exactly the Paul Engels perspective, which is you take talented people who think that they have talent, and you submit them to a series of, in a sense, public pressure groups where they in vigorous debate with their colleagues, with their classmates in the workshop format, test their capacity to produce something that others find acceptable. So there, the norm is really gauged by people who are your immediate readers and who give you feedback on the spot. That's very, very different from the way in which I think writing historically, at least, was, came to surface, or how literature, the birth of literary texts, was organized in other parts of the world. And today, it's in part, I think, the internet, but I kind of wonder whether the certainly in Czech slash O slash Slovakia, the introduction of this new form of creative writing isn't to some extent a re-import of this American pragmatic tradition with the people who were returning after 1989. You know, so I think that in some ways the this this new mode of teaching creative writing as a pedagogic and perhaps as a kind of professional-oriented inclination is something that may be part of that feedback loop of exile and return. I have no evidence for this. This is a pure speculation, but I certainly know that the notion of creative writing as a kind of a profession, as it's cultivated here, stands, I think, in sharp contrast to these other intellectual traditions, and yet at the same time, it's been extremely popular because I think that we now have the situation where we have, you know, so many young people are what you would call prosumers, people who are both producers and consumers at the same time. So this whole, you know, torrent of fan literature or people who calque their writing on popular genres and publish it online are extremely successful. To some extent, it's like folk music, or it's like folk writing, you could almost say, you know. In
Yes.
other words, it's really it fulfills different social needs. I did want to add this last thing, which is that, you know, we are actually not the oldest creative writing program in the world. The Gorky Institute in Moscow is, which started teaching proletarian, you know, candidates and turning them into proletarian writers in the late 1920s. And
Of
that's
course.
too is a kind of a version of this professionalization of writing that is not in the spirit of resistance or individual voice, or certainly not this
Drive.
no, not the ethical drive, but
Yes.
it fulfills other needs. Okay.
Right, thank you. Now, your students at the translation workshop edit a journal called Exchanges, and then you also edit a journal called 95th Meridian. Could you say a little bit about these two journals and also about your journal's most recent pandemic, issues?
So, even from the early 70s on, when Paul and Nie Hualing Engel started boosting the program and trying to make it be get it to survive and thrive, they understood that publishing translation was an absolutely essential part of what the purpose of the program. And they were very, very diligent in commissioning, finding, and publishing monographs of translations of material that nobody was paying attention to at all. So, you know, you have a collection of Bulgarian poetry published in early 1970s or Korean poetry at a point where nobody was doing that sort of a thing. So there's a long tradition of that. But of course, and then out of that, out of the MFA in literary translation, the journal Exchanges was born, in part because one of its directors for a little while was Danny Weisbord, and so he had it kind of in his DNA that, you know, if you have translation, you must have publication to go with it. So Exchanges comes from dates back to the early or mid 70s or so, and then eventually it kind of died on the vine, and then it was resuscitated once internet made that possible. 91st, not 95th Meridian, which is the meridian that runs through Iowa City, just to place us on the global map, is a journal that it was part of my brief when I first was hired to start an electronic journal. So 91st Meridian has been coming out for nearly 20 years. Was a little bit more dormant during a certain period, but essentially my feeling is I try to combine in that journal contributions from our alumni or writers who've been here, in other words, work that I know through the IWP grid, but also open submissions from writers for wherever. And essentially the only requirement is that we publish, as the mission statement says, work that somehow is beyond the national. And the COVID issues were simply, we had two issues where we wrote to our alumni, of which we have many, and asked in the first issue, you know, how has the quarantine changed the situation around you? And the second one is, what do you think is going to be left after the quarantine is over, and what social changes will follow from that? And some answers were predictably boring, and some answers were incredibly interesting. So I recommend everyone to go visit the IWP website, find the issues of 91st Meridian, and read for themselves.
Okay, so they're all online. Wonderful. So I think we're coming to an end. I just wanted to ask very briefly, because I know that your range of interests is so broad that you probably don't have much time or capacity to follow Slovak literature, but to the extent that you have been able to follow it, which writers in Slovakia, past or present, do you find most interesting? And is there someone who you believe should be introduced to Anglophone readers?
I am so ashamed, and I so do not want to answer this question, because I really that would only be make any sense if I really had some ongoing and active engagement with Slovak literature. Whenever I go to Bratislava, I go to the bookstores at Forum and Martinus and whatever I can, and I pick up as many books as will fit into the suitcase, and I read. But then, when I go back to Sweden, to my parents' house, where their exile literature and their the few books that they've managed to bring over, and the many books that they eventually that people sent them, I read differently. And in both cases, I read less for individual authors and for visions. I read more for this to gain or to keep track a little bit of the changes that Slovenčina, that Slovak language has undergone in the last, in these many shifts. And so for in the contempt I read for the new words and the inflection of perhaps English, the loss of Czechisms or the gains of Czechisms in the contemporary Slovak writers. And then I go back and read the writers who have not had any contact with outside world, at least linguistically, because I've been re lately been immersed in Kukučin at nights whenever I go to my dad's house in Lund and Zgorishka, precisely for that, for a Slovak that's completely, I don't want to say pure purismus, I don't want to say uncontaminated, I just mean to say a Slovak as it was before media took it on. And then at the same time, I'm extremely interested in the way in which, a Hvoretsky, let's say, or a Beňová capture the Slovak as it's as it's changing, month by or year by year in the contemporary world. So it's somewhat cowardly, but actually truly honest answer.
Well, this is an absolutely legitimate take, so really there's no need to apologize. And I'm really, really grateful to you for taking time to answer all these questions. And we're in August, which is the Women in Translation Month, so I'm really glad that we were able to mention some women writers and also to pay a tribute to your mother, Ludmila Durovičová, and Huling Engler. So, thank you very much, and take care, and
Dovidenia.
yeah. Dovidenia,
Dovidenia,
ahoj.
do počutia, ahoj.